This is a Collider.com audio interview.
So what was the path of this movie, you know, starting up, having to stop, and then having to start up again?
And stopping again, and starting again, and then stopping again.
What was that process like?
I didn't really... I'd done a film in Africa, The Ghost in the Darkness, years ago, where we were plagued by terrible floods, and actually several people died, hit by lightning, and terrible things happened, and it was a terrible experience, but it was sort of contained, and it was a really big budget film. We could keep going and fix stuff and everything. This film, you know, was never a big budget movie, and so we started off a few weeks in Katrina hit, and then we were evacuated, and then you come back to a film crew who have lost everything. All the film crew, all the actors, they've lost everywhere. They have nowhere to live. They've lost their friends, their pets, and a lot of, and people are reeling, and of course the government, I'm afraid, is doing nothing. And so they pick themselves up and they try and fix things, and we weren't sure when we came back that whether we should continue, what was the proper thing to do, and the crew and the people said, please don't leave. If you leave, hey, we're not going to be being paid, we're not going to have anywhere to live, because all their families moved into the hotel rooms where we were shooting, but still trying to get people, and also they wanted something else to focus on, because it's such an impotent situation, there was nothing you could do about it when you were there. You know, if your house is destroyed underwater, there's nothing you can do about it. You know, and you have to wait for a while to figure these things out. And then we had to hand over a lot of our equipment to FEMA, lights, generators, Motorolas. You couldn't make phone calls because the airwaves were full. You couldn't send emails. And you're in the middle of nowhere, and it was difficult to push it along and make it happen, this film. But then actually the local people were so extraordinarily generous. And we had, you know, also Baton Rouge, where we were sort of based. You know, you had 600,000 refugees, so all the churches were full, and the churches were great, and the people gave up. I mean, it was a mixture of all sorts of bizarreness. And of course, the big thing was that you're doing this film. Rita was actually worse, I think, for where we were. But you have this film where everyone's questioning faith in the movie, and now you're surrounded by a whole generation of people who are questioning their faith in God. Why would God let this terrible thing happen? You know, you go down to the refuges to work, and people would say, how can God let these tragedies happen? It was so interesting because it was so connected to the film. You know, that it became, I don't know if it became helpful or not, but it became certainly a part of the fabric of the movie.
David was telling us a story that the scene where the kids get their hair cut, mm-hmm. you actually, you know, obviously you must have cut kids' hair, but we didn't realize there's as many as may have been in the movie.
Yeah, loads.
And that it sounds like the kids were crying. Like, really crying?
We paid these kids, like, we offered $200 for any kid who wanted to do it, right? And these kids went, $200? Yes. And all these kids came in, and I would ask them all, I'd say, why do you want your happy haircut? I said, because it would piss off my parents. You know? Okay. There's a good reason, like that. And the cash, and this and that. And they loved. But then it was funny, as soon as it started happening, there's some reaction. Not all the kids. Some of the kids were going, oh, yes, but some of the kids, even though they were really excited about it, as soon as they started getting a haircut, they would stop. Tears start pouring out of their eyes because there's some connection. Do you know? I mean, there's some, especially for the girls, there's some great loss, you know, which happened. It's a very emotional moment for them. And afterwards, they'd be happy again. They didn't know what happened. It was a very interesting, spontaneous reaction that I wasn't expecting.
And then were the lice CGI?
No, we put real lice in there. No, they were tiny actors in suits. I've had lice. I mean, my daughter had lice at school in England. I mean, it's not the weirdest thing in the world. But, and a lot of the kids had lice, you know, no, so they knew what it was like.
They didn't know if you had a lice wrangler.
It would have been great, wouldn't it, to do that? Get some good acting then.
This is the first Dark Castle kind of produced film in a while that the press is seeing and sort of getting access to in interviews, mm-hmm. and I'm very happy about that, but I'm curious. Do you have a sense going into a movie like this that the horror or thriller genres don't get as much respect from critics as other more mainstream fare?
I guess you're right. I guess it's easier to dump on a horror film, isn't it? The interesting thing about this Dark Castle, when I first got the script, it was not something I wanted to do. It was kind of more like the other Dark Castle films for me, which was otherworldly. Do you know what I mean? Like, they take place in a reality that is a different universe slightly. Do you know what I mean? And I thought, I've done lots of those films, I wasn't so interested. And then when Hillary called up and talked to me, and she called me up and said, look, why don't you do this, because we can do something interesting and some interesting themes in it. And then I got more excited because I thought we could do something entertaining and creepy and with some interesting themes in it. Well, I think there's some very interesting themes in this film about loss of faith and different belief systems and stuff. And fundamentalism, I think. You know, Hillary's a fundamentalist in this. She doesn't believe in God. And anyone who does is stupid. You know, and then there's the other fundamentalists in the film who believe in their God and everyone else is wrong. You know, and I think fundamentalism just breeds self-destruction, whether it's ethical, religious, moral, political, whatever. And I thought, you know, with Hillary in it, you could do something more real and more, for me, more creepy. It's more creepy for me to see films where you're in an ordinary world and then underneath that ordinary world something is happening. You know, the great horror films are the ones, those ones are the ones like whether they're The Exorcist or Don't Look Now or Sixth Sense, or you're kind of watching it and you're kind of believing it. And that's more creepy to me than, you know, sort of magical things happening, and it's clearly you're not meant to believe it, which is a different type of film, which is also fun, but I just don't get. So, I mean, I think because Hillary's in this and because that allowed Hillary's presence, and I think to some extent my presence, allowed it to be a wee bit more psychological and more of a thriller than a horror, straight-out horror movie, and to have twists and turns. I think that's what really got me excited in doing it, because it's not so much like a Dark Castle film in a way, you know. And I think Dark Castle have made some really fun, like Gothic a lot, and which, well, you must have had done press for that, right, with Halle Berry and stuff.
I did.
Yeah.
But you know, some films like House of Wax are sort of more kids' fun films, you know. And I guess I don't know. Maybe they don't feel like they need critics' help on this film. I don't know what the deal is, you know, on that. But I know what you mean. But I mean, I think Sixth Sense and those kind of movies, you know, Shyamalan's films, and there's a couple of other directors I think who do films which are genre films that make you think. I like that. If you can do that.
Some filmmakers like to watch certain films before attacking a project.
I know, for the 85th time, I watched Exorcist again, because, you know, and I'm, to this day, you know, she's going up in the attic, and I'm going, please don't go up there. I'm so pathetic, I'm so, but you know, Friedkin did this very sort of documentary-style feeling of something where you felt like, you know, it was based on a true story to a certain extent, and if you felt like this could have happened. It was such a, you know, deeply felt movie, you know. One of my favorite horror films ever is Don't Look Now. I mean, that film, I remember freaking out when I saw that film as a kid, and I still watch it nowadays. And The Sixth Sense was a great film. And these films you're watching, it's just. But I couldn't find a film which had put anything from the Old Testament biblical stuff into a contemporary setting. There didn't seem to be one out there, and I have a lot. I mean, The Omen is from Book of Revelations in the New Testament, and that's an easy one, I think. You know, there's 666 and all that kind of fun stuff. But there was nothing I could find anywhere just to relate to, you know, to watch it.
There was a Dr. Fives movie about the plagues.
I love the Dr. Fives movies. In fact, I used to know the director. Who's the director of the first Dr. Fives movie? He directed a lot of the Avengers TV series. He lived across the road from me in London when I was growing up. He was a great guy. It's cool. Yeah.
Does this movie, for you, do you think this is believable? And like The Exorcist, and that could happen to do this stuff?
I don't think you can make films like The Exorcist nowadays. They're too slow and they're too thrown out. You know, whatever. It's like, you know, those films are no longer even able to be made, I don't think, really. Because nowadays, people's attention span is so short. You know, I have a version of this film which I think is longer, which is probably more creepy, but I think a lot of people think it would be boring, because nothing ever happens. You know, I kind of like atmosphere in films, but I think it's actually quite a short film, this, I think. It's about 90 minutes long or something. But I think it feels like there's tons of information in this film. I think there's massive amounts of information that you have to absorb in it. You know, and all the twists and turns that you have to set up, and hopefully there's not too much lying going on. I remember when I was a kid reading an Agatha Christie story, and there's one clue at the end which you weren't told in the book, and I went back and checked it, and I thought, no, you can't do that. You can have a twist at the end and then not tell someone a really important piece of information. It's not fair. So we tried to do that in this film, you know, to serve both masters, you know.
What are your plans for the DVD?
I don't know. We were talking about doing something, something, you know, which shouldn't be allowed to be rated. We're going to see. There's not a lot of stuff that we shot that's not in there, you know. But it's, but there's going to be some fun stuff. I think we had some plans of doing a much raunchier version of this, and we're just going to look into it now.
Like gory or
yeah,
death and stuff.
Yeah. Yes, more sex, more gore, all that kind of fun stuff.
It's already rated R. I mean, what's stopping you?
Do you feel like it's an R-rated film? Does it feel like
it? It doesn't. That's why I'm surprised.
Kids, I mean, I don't think a kid might get scared watching.
Yes, I think so.
The fear factor, maybe. Mm-hmm.
But I think so. I mean, I think it's. I was surprised it became R-rated in the end. If you see films like The Ring or whatever, I think that's a creepy film and that's gory. And it's, I think, actually, to a certain extent, it's R-rated because there's biblical references in it. And it's one of the feedback I got. I think it's, you know, there's a... The Ring is based on a legend that's made up. This is based on something that a lot of people believe is the truth. So.
How hypocritical do you think the MPAA is?
We've been at war for years, and I've had my run-ins with them. Joel and them are basically just at war the whole time with his movies. I just don't. You know, I come from to a certain extent a different culture. As much as I spend time in America, I spend time in England, you know, and Australia and stuff too. And TV there at 9 o'clock at night, you can see full nudity and swearing and violence and whatever you want. In fact, there's less violence over there than there is here, but it's just not so, you know, on network TV, on TV with commercials. It's just a different world, you know. And America is, you know, in my lifetime, you know, the movies that I grew up with in the 70s, you know, couldn't be made now. They're too ambiguous. They're too, you know, the subject matter is strange. The premises are crazy. There's sex and, you know, all sorts of stuff in them. And I think the world's gone backwards, you know, the MPAs, you know, has gone backwards. I think it's there's a legal issues to things, if people want to sue you, I suppose, and all that kind of stuff. But I think 15, 20 years ago, this wouldn't have been an R-rated film, I think.
Isn't it intimidating having to fight on the show as a Steve, does he impose
it all as a... No, I've done two films and Joel, and I've done three Tales from the Crypts over the years. He left me completely alone. He just comes in and helps when this stuff needs to happen. Yeah. And that's the only way that this kind of film could happen, I think.
Can you talk a little bit about working with Hillary on set? What she's like?
She's you know, super prepared. She likes not to really see. If she hasn't seen something in the film, she'd rather not see it before you walk on, which is a little complicated when you're trying to block and light things. But it's an interesting. I also like it. I mean, when I did 24 or whatever, you know, I would actually block scenes and shoot them the first time, not show the cameraman even what we'd done, just so they'd have that feeling of trying to keep up with it. You know, it's what Friedkin did in, I think, in The Exorcist and also in French Connection. He would set up scenes, not show our camera operator, and then just put the camera operator in there, and then he'd have to try and fire, and I kind of like that. So on the first takes, I would do that a lot of the time, and then once they knew it, then you could, you know, you start organizing yourself differently. And she kind of liked that. I think she liked the idea of her first reaction, because in a film like this, there's so many reactions to so many things, and you're not shooting in order. And especially with all the trouble we had, we were all over the place trying to pick up bits here and shoot there. So, you know, it's quite an acting task for her to have kept, you know, through everything that we went through to try and keep that thing going. I mean, she couldn't be more helpful. She's incredibly well organized. She's on her BlackBerry too much. I would take it off her. Don't get the BlackBerry back until you're finished. Take. But then sometimes she would sneak another BlackBerry on, and she would actually text me while she was acting with her back to camera, just to kind of show me that she liked it, but only in fun, silly things. And she's has the dirtiest sense of humor of anyone I know, I think. And she's cool.
She plays a tough character, but there's a real vulnerable side to her.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how did you get that vulnerability out of her?
I think in some films, Hillary doesn't come across as vulnerable. Actually, she comes across as a little cold in some movies. And I think it's something that she is aware of now, and something that we were really making sure that we had. You know, because on one hand, she's playing a character who's very cut off from emotions. It's very tough, very scientific, you know, clearly courageous, so you don't want to betray that. On the other hand, you have, it's tough, you know, we've all seen the trailer, so we know it's a supernatural film, but you've got a character in the film who doesn't, and you don't want the audience to think, hey, don't be an idiot. We all know. So it's a really fine line. So she has to be this character, but she has to, you have to see her starting to change and her belief system fall to pieces. You have to, whatever she's set in her life to help her get through her life after the tragedy that she's been through and the loss of faith has to come apart very quickly. Here was my task to myself. I'm going, okay, I meet this character on Friday, and by Sunday afternoon, she's trying to murder a child. You know? And I'm going, how do you go from one place to another? How would I personally, what would make me believe so much that I could come to that? There's a great scene at the end of The Omen when Gregory Peck is trying to kill his own son. And we all know this kid's evil. We've seen it. We've seen him kill the wife. We've seen him organize these terrible things, being surrounded by Rottweilers and lots of fun stuff. Carves his hair off. There's 666 right there. No doubt about it at all. And of course, you still can't do it because you can't. It's your own child. I mean, it'd be impossible, however much you believed it. And I think, how do you get to that point where she's really willing to do it? And so, Anna Sophia is such a good actress, and she and I had our own ideas going on. Anna Sophia's truth is that she's an ill-educated, almost mute child who lives in the backwoods who becomes incredibly powerful. And she doesn't know why or how or what's happening. And it's, so for her, that was her thing. And so that's the truth of the story for her. And there's different deities involved, clearly. But making you believe that this child was that scary and dangerous. And it was interesting. I've seen a bunch of reviews, actually, of stuff. And a lot of people really hone in on Anna Sophia. Because, not being able to speak makes it difficult to put up a performance, but she's completely committed. And if you watch the film back, and you can see that I don't think we've cheated with her character.
Yeah. Was the ending of the movie always set up? It seems like it sets it up for the possibility of a sequel, whether you're involved or someone else is involved. Was it always that way?
No, not at all. Actually, no, it wasn't. And I put that ending on the end just because I thought it was a fun, interesting idea, because there's a lot of different ways you can interpret that, and what was the point of her ever coming there and all sorts of stuff. And obviously, there's a twist none of us ever talk about.
Right.
I don't think there'll be a sequel to it. I mean, the plagues are all done, right? So that's that.
And everyone's dead.
Yeah.
So do you have coming out that might not be in the press
release? I just shot a TV pilot for Showtime with David Duchovny and Natasha McElhone, which I love. And it hasn't got a name yet, but it is jam-packed with fornication and cursing. It's like a great 1970s shampoo movie. It's super raunchy, and it's the great stuff you can do on TV that you can't do in the cinema anymore. I think it's really crazy.
What's the premise of the movie?
He's just a 40-year-old guy in LA. He's a writer. He writes a book called God Hates Us All, and he hates everybody, and it's turned into a turned into a terrible film called A Crazy Little Thing Called Love with Tom and Katie, and then he's breaking up with his wife, and he's fornicating with everyone he can to pay her back for leaving him, and it's just a riot. I've never seen anything like it on television.
And this is the pilot.
Yeah, I shot a half-hour pilot in January while I was still finishing this one. I must have been crazy. It just got picked up by Showtime. I'll start off this TV series, start shooting in June. I'll do the first bunch of them. And there'll only be 12 episodes. It's like Weeds. It's going to run with Weeds. Sort of companion.
What about television that separates from film? You're saying things you can do on television.
I think it's where really a lot of grown-ups can get their stuff. I remember when I was doing 24, they said, look, in cinema now is mostly for kids a lot of the time. And there's a lot of things you can't show in cinema because I think the MPAA are very tough. But on TV, we can do stuff, even at 9 o'clock at night, the first season of 24, I think the opening, we blow up a plane, Jack cuts this guy's finger off. I mean, they're trying to make it bigger every year. Now he's cutting the whole torso off. I don't know what he's doing now. But it was something that they said, look, we're different from TV, film. We can do this and get away with it. and we want people talking about it, you know. Oh. And for this Showtime thing, I mean, if they're doing the life and death of Peter Sellers for HBO, was just splendid. I mean, we couldn't put it in the cinema here. It was in the cinema the rest of the world, but here there was no cinemas that wanted it because they thought it was an art film. You know, I didn't see it that way.
Well, it would have been an art film. It would have been in a theater. But
I don't know. It's not that arty. It's quite fun. I mean, it's a crazy film. But
the way that it moves and the way that it moves and it's structured, it's very different from a film that we would see in the theater that would be a major studio release.
Yes, yeah.
It's non-linear structure.
Yeah, but I was the happiest man who was picked to be in competition at Cannes, you know, so it's a movie, but you're right, it's not a movie, it seems like, for the multiplexes, but it goes back to that thing we were talking about when we were, you know, when I was growing up, these
and
were
how,
the movies.
How good is Jeffrey Rush? I mean, were there moments when you just felt that this is as good as it gets?
It's hard to work with an actor that brilliant and that much fun. I mean, this guy would get in, he would never sleep for 4 months. I could only shoot with him for 3 hours a day because he was in makeup and 4 or 5 hours a day, wardrobe for hours. He was an amazing guy. You know, if you're a smart director, you surround yourself with great actors. You know, I mean, you don't get anyone better than Hillary or David or Idris. You know, in that movie, I had the best actors you could possibly work with, and it just makes your life easier and it makes it more fun. You know, I'm not a director who goes, I have this overall vision of how exactly everything has to be. You want actors to come on board and show you stuff, and you want the shooting not to just be finishing off a series of storyboards. You want the shooting to be alive and you know, feel exciting when you're there and you can change stuff. But you know, and then that's, you know, as I say, you've got Hillary on camera, it's great. You just know that she's going to really help you through this complicated film, you know, and that's all the difference in the world, I think. I'd be an idiot if I hired the wrong actor, I think.